exotic superconductors we've been looking at as well. So the overall question is sort of, which has so been with us for quite a long time, is strontium ruthenate a chiral P-wave superconductor? Why might you care? Well, such a chiral P-wave state is a topological superconducting state, and maybe someday in 100 years from now, Alan's follower will be telling us about devices made of topological quantum computers made out of this very beautiful material operating below 1 Kelvin. So what is strontium ruthenate? It's the first superconducting layered perovskite without copper in it, which is I guess there's lots of materials that are the first of something. It's got the same crystal structure as lanthanum cuprate, but the difference between lanthanum cuprate, which you have to dope to make it superconduct, is if you take pure strontium ruthenate, this material is metallic as you grow it, if you grow it really purely, and it's superconducting with a TC below about 1.5 Kelvin in the best samples. The normal state of this material are quite nice. It's an anisotropic three-dimensional metal. Here there are beautiful pictures of the Fermi surface. It's got these are sort of covers of physics today and things like that because they're so beautiful. Those you can see the different bands here, and it's a real sort of textbook Fermi liquid in this way. The first indication that something is strange in the superconducting state comes from just how sensitive TC is on the residual resistivity. Andy McKenzie showed this quite a long time ago. And essentially, if you measure the residual resistivity, you can predict TC. And this is why, in fact, these materials have to be made very clean to superconduct. Only strontium ruthenate that's been grown in a floating zone furnace where there is no impurities, there's no crucible that involved. Those are the only samples that have been made superconducting, which I think the very recent, somebody has finally made a superconducting thin film, but sort of 20 years after the discovery of superconductivity in this material. Evidence that there's some sort of anisotropic pairing came from NMR. If you look at the 1 over T1, there's no Hebel-Schlichter peak at just about around TC. And then this susceptibility drops, sort of calling a power law. The 1 over T1 follows a power law, which is often the sign of potential nodes in the gap, et cetera. There is the spin susceptibility, which is essentially measuring in a normal S-wave superconductor with the spins when they're paired into a singlet state should have no susceptibility, so this should follow a so-called Yoshida function going down. Instead, it's been found for both directions to be temperature independent, and this is consistent with a P-wave state. This is the same sort of measurement. Instead of this is induced moment form factor, you polarize the spins and then you scatter with neutrons. And again, you see in a conventional superconductor like vanadium silicide, you see a drop in the susceptibility below TC, and in strontium ruthenate, it stays unchanged. So we looked at the system with MuSR, and MuSR is a technique where you implant a spin polarized particle, the muon, it implants into the sample. The muons are made polarized from the way they're formed from pions. We can prepare the polarization in whatever direction we want. The muon enters, we start a clock, and then the muon spin processes in the sample. The muon then decays with about a 2 microsecond lifetime, and giving us a positron and a couple of neutrinos. We detect the positron and we stop the clock when that happens. So here's the movie of the muon coming in. It processes, the clock's turning, there goes the positron, and we stop the clock. Then a second muon comes along, we do this one muon at a time, does the same thing, it decays, and we stop the clock at another time, and we do this perhaps 20 million times, and we build up a histogram for each of our detectors, which has, of course, the muon lifetime curve of 2 microseconds on there, but superimposed upon that is the projection of the muon spin onto the direction of our counter. We see an enhancement of the counting rate when the spin is pointing towards the detector, and we see a decrease in the counting rate when it's pointing away from the detector. We can then take pairs of opposing counters. For example, in a transverse field geometry, we have two detectors up and above, and we have our field in this direction. And then, so here's actual data. You see the muon lifetime and then the polarization upon that. We form an asymmetry where we take the difference in the count rates between two opposing counters and divide it by their sum. They all contain the muon lifetime, and so all of that cancels out, and we end up with a signal which is just proportional to the spin polarization function. So in a precession measurement like I'm showing you here, the information of interest would be something like, it would be like a free induction decay in the language of nuclear magnetic resonance. So the sort of things we can do here, we can do, these are a sample for our dilution refrigerator, such as we used in strontium ruthenate. So there's a scale there. You can see some very small little crystals glued onto the end of that copper sample holder. So there we're looking at about a quarter of a square centimeter type of sample. We can do measurements in very high magnetic field. We can get up to about a 7.5 Tesla applied field, which in which case the muon spin is about a gigahertz. So we need to have roughly 100 picosecond timing resolution to resolve our signals. We could also do experiments under high pressure, getting down to about 2.5 Kelvin in 22,000 atmospheres, and land about half of the muons in the sample when we do that. So in zero field, because the spins are polarized by nuclear physics, we don't have to apply a magnetic field to generate polarization. And so we can look at the magnetism associated with the sample just itself. So here's calcium ruthenate, which is isostructural and isoelectronic to strontium ruthenate, but it's in fact a mod insulator. And so in fact you see precession here in the absence of a magnetic field, and that's due to the internal magnetic order. So we can measure the temperature dependence of this precession frequency, and that just corresponds to the square root of a Bragg peak intensity in neutron scattering. That's an order parameter for the magnetic state. So we can do that, though, if we have a disordered system, because of the muons are a real space probe. If we have a disordered system where we don't have a unique field, you'll still see a characteristic relaxation. And by plotting the relaxation rate as a function of temperature, for example, you can build up, you can do the same sort of thing as if you plotted the frequency. And so here, looking at as we go from calcium ruthenate to strontium ruthenate, how we can go across the entire phase diagram and look and go from the antiferromagnetic system over here to the pure superconductor in here and various types of doping. Okay, so the interest of strontium ruthenate comes about is also something that Alan mentioned in his talk just previously, is the idea of broken time reversal symmetry. It turns out that the punchline, of course, is that strontium ruthenate is a broken time reversal symmetry superconductor, and it turns out we think that the wave function is basically a kx plus or minus iky state, and so we know from the cuprates, for example, that there the order parameter is a dx squared minus y squared, so you have these nodes along the 45 degree angles. This kx plus or minus iky state will turn out to be nodeless. But just like in a ferromagnet, where you could spin in the absence of a biasing field, you can go into a spin up or a spin down, and those are completely degenerate. The kx plus iky state and the kx minus iky state are completely degenerate. There's just the sense of the chirality, if you like, of the order parameter is different. And so, if these two states are degenerate, and you cool your sample below TC, some parts of the sample will just spontaneously choose one state, and the other another part will choose the other state. And so there'll be interfaces between these two systems. So now you have in the interface region, you have essentially a gradient in the phase of the order parameter, and so that gives you a real physical current that goes along that, just like essentially a Josephson current. And so this has been calculated long before it was observed, and so one can see that, for example, here's the calculation from Sigerson Ueda of the current density here, where x equals zero is the boundary. So you have one phase on one side and the other phase on the other side. Here's the current that flows along there, and there's the magnetic field that's generated. So if you have a boundary between a kx plus and a kx minus state, you'll have a supercurrent that flows along there, and the supercurrent will decay on the length scale of the penetration depth of the superconductor, which is on the order of hundreds of nanometers in this material. You should also, of course, get these at the surfaces, because you have a kx plus iky state, for example, at the surface, and outside is vacuum, so there should be a supercurrent flowing on the surface, which should also make a magnetic field there. So we did a zero field MuSR measurement, and here's some data. This is from our paper quite a while ago, but you see that above TC, the relaxation is quite small. That's due to the nuclear dipole moments, and as you cool down to 20 millikelvin here, there's a small but finite increase in the relaxation rate. We now plot the relaxation rate as a function of temperature. Here's for different orientations of the sample. These are for very high quality samples with 1.5 Kelvin TCs. And you see that the magnetic field appears right at TC for both directions. And here's for a sample, again, the high purity sample. And here's a lower purity sample with a lower TC. And again, we see the spontaneous field appears at the superconducting transition temperature. So it's presumably not some coincidental other magnetic phase happening, but it's really associated with superconductivity. That was that for the other other groups have seen the spontaneous fields in strontium ruthenate as well. It's not the final word on this on the study. The group of Kapitolnik at Stanford did some very nice care rotation measurements. And again, they're measuring essentially the magnetization of the sample and following a fairly complicated training procedure where they apply fields and remove them and things like that in a way that I don't understand. They're able to see a spontaneous magnetization appearing here, again, leading to the conclusion that strontium ruthenate breaks time reversal symmetry. However, surface probes, Cam Moeller's group at Stanford came along they have these very sensitive scanning probes. They could use scanning Hall probes and scanning squids. They did some very nice measurements looking at the tricrystals and things like that in the cuprates. So they expected to see these supercurrents flowing along the edges of the sample. And so here's what they expected to see in their measurement, and here's what they actually saw. This is, I think, on a scanning squid, and this is from Moeller's group looking using a scanning Hall probe. Again, they have very good signal to noise, and there's what they expect for the currents they would see on the surface, and there's what they measure. And so both on the edge of the sample and where they thought they would have a domain wall, and again, there's no effect. So there's a contrast, there's a conflict there between these measurements, which I think is still, is not an experimental contrast. Their data says what it does, and ours says what ours does. And so it may be a theoretical, I think, is there's, Catherine Callan's doing some work trying to understand this theoretically. should point out that there are tunneling measurements which can detect the edge states that are associated with this chiral superconducting state as well. They can do, people have done tunneling into the edge of these things, and there they do see the edge states. So, but they're not. That's a separate measurement from measuring the currents themselves. I should just to take a little bit of a side now to some other non-conventional superconductors that also do and do not show broken time reversal symmetry. The scuttered-rutite, praseodymium, osmium, and antimonide. This is group work from Aoki et al. There again, you can see above TC, you see just this relaxation here. This is sort of a Kubo-Tayabe form due to nuclear dipole moments. And then as they cool down to low temperature, they see an enhancement of the relaxation rate. And you can see that it onsets again at the, I guess there's two TCs in this material. But they see it, and it's a little bit hard to resolve, but they see it at least appearing in the vicinity of the two TCs. And again, the scanning squid measurements, you have to sort of know how to interpret this, but they see no evidence for these edge currents in this material as well. So this is a second material, like strontium ruthenate, where the fields are seen inside in the bulk, but no currents are seen at the edges. Uranium platinum 3 is a heavy fermion superconductor. And again, in zero field many years ago, we found broken time reversal symmetry below the lower of the two transition temperatures. However, it's not seen in Europe. It's only seen in Canada. The group doing the experiments in Europe had what they thought was an extremely pure sample. They went to great lengths of electropurification, et cetera, and they saw no spontaneous magnetic field within their sample. One explanation of this, of course, is if the spontaneous domain walls are pinned by defects in the sample, having a slightly less perfect sample with a few more defects may make it possible to see these more readily, since the fields only occur within about a penetration depth of the domain wall. So it may be that they should have been a little bit sloppier or less perfect in their sample preparation. I should point out though that 21 years after our original observation, now it's also now seen in California, where again beautiful care rotation measurements by Kapitolnik's group also see the beginning of the care rotation at the lower transition temperature. And this is also on a very pure sample. These are one of these beautiful samples that have been made by Jan's former supervisor, following Jan's recipe. Okay. We've been looking at non-centrosymmetric superconductors. They're a place where you can't really think about purely having a S wave or P wave, et cetera. People looked at strontium platinum arsenic here, which is one particular non-centrosymmetric superconductor. And there they do see a spontaneous magnetic field, really, really small, I should point out, in this material below TC. But in another one, lanthanum platinum silicon, there's no evidence for that. You can see the temperature dependence at that point. So it doesn't seem that symmetric, whether you're centrosymmetric or not, may or may not give you broken time reversal symmetry. Looking at some of these latest interesting topological or potentially topological superconductors, here's a bismuth selenide, which if you intercalate copper into it, you can turn it from a topological insulator into a superconductor. TC is about 3 degrees in this particular sample, and you can see that there's in the tunneling measurements there's a very strong zero bias conduction peak, which is taken as evidence for a topological superconducting state, and that's seen both in this material and in this other one, tin indium telluride. And in both of these materials, we see zero. This is sort of unpublished data from our group. We see no increase in the relaxation rate whatsoever with TC in these samples. So these materials, which are potentially topological superconductors, and there's some experimental evidence to that nature, but do not have broken time reversal symmetry. Okay. So let me spend a little bit of time coming back to strontium ruthenate now and talk a little bit more about our determination of the state. Gin, just like John A? Excellent, thank you. So we see broken time reversal symmetry in our zero field mu SR, which makes this the most likely state. If you look at the big book by Sigrist, or the big article by Sigrist and Ueda, which gives you all the possible superconducting states, this state is nodeless, okay? You can see that the size of the gap as you go around the Fermi surface remains constant, and so there should be no nodes. And this is in contrast with some measurements, for example. Here's some work by Christian Lupien looking at, I guess this was ultrasound. There was thermal conductivity measurements. And there was also some measurements of the penetration depth using tunnel diode or AC measurements. So we decided to use a transverse field MuSR looking in the vortex state. So here you have, this is an STM picture, because they look prettier, of the vortex lattice. I think this is probably in niobium diselenide. You can see that you have in the mixed state, the flux penetrates in the form of vortices, so the field is very large near a vortex core, and then it dies off on the length scale of the penetration depth going away from the vortexes. So if you, the length scale of the intervortex spacing is given by the magnetic field, and it's typically hundreds of angstroms for sort of Tesla-type fields, and longer as the fields go down, of course. So if the muons land at a unique crystallographic sites, but they essentially sample the entire vortex lattice because the crystallographic lattice is very, very small compared to the length scale I'm showing you here. So if the muons go in and if a particular muon lands near a vortex core, it'll see a large field and process quickly. If the muon lands away from the vortex cores, the field will be smaller, it'll process more slowly. So the muons will all dephase. And so that's what you see here, and this is showing the relaxation, the spin precession signal, and some of them are going fast and some of them are slower and they're dephasing. If we Fourier transform that, you're just making a field probability map, so you'll have very high fields out near the vortex cores, there'll be a minimum field somewhere at the center of the lattice, for example, here, and there'll be a most likely field, which is sort of somewhere along this line here, and then there'll often be a little background peak for the sample holder. So from a spectrum like this, the things that affect the overall line shape are the penetration depth, which basically gives you the width of this Fourier transform, and the coherence length, which mostly affects the cutoff field at the vortex core, and also the lattice geometry. So if you have a square lattice versus a triangular lattice, you get a somewhat different field probability spectrum. So by fitting, and so this is just showing that here, this is for a vanadium silicide, where you can go from a square lattice to a triangular lattice, and you can actually distinguish those. In the interest of time, I'll sort of go over that quickly. So what we've done, what we can do in a number of these superconductors is you can measure the penetration depth, which is basically 1 over the penetration depth squared is the superfluid density. If you measure that as a function of temperature, that's one sort of order parameter, if you like, for the superconducting state. And you may remember that in the case of the cuprates, where we have line nodes, the penetration depth at low temperatures has that very nice linear dependence. This is what Walter Hardy originally found with microwave measurements and then was followed up by Jeff Sonnier, et cetera, with MuSR. And so in the case of the cobalt dope, barium iron, arsenic superconductor, this is a system where at optimal doping, you get a very high superfluid density, and this is a so-called S plus and minus gap state. And as you increase the doping, in fact, what we found is that the temperature dependence turns from being flat at low temperature to actually having a slope. And so in this system, it looks like we go from an S plus or minus to a D wave gap with different amounts of doping. So by measuring the temperature dependence, you're sensitive to the gap geometry. Things are a little bit complicated with strontium ruthenate. It turns out that it's known that it's a square vortex lattice rather than a triangular. These are usually quite close in energy, and most systems triangular wins out. But in strontium ruthenate, the underlying Fermi surface geometry favors a square lattice. So you can see this nice fourfold pattern and seen in neutron scattering from small angle scattering. Dan Agterberg, who's a graduate of Toronto, and I think has been to one of these meetings before, did some detailed calculations with the actual involving the Fermi surface of strontium ruthenate, and they were able to take the neutron data here. This is for the fraction pattern, build in a certain amount of Fermi surface anisotropy, and generate a field probability map, which works quite well, and is very different from a more traditional superconductor, even with a square vortex lattice. But the important point about all this is from that, we can calculate, given the theoretical model now, we can calculate what the relaxation rate or the line shape will be as a function of the microscopic parameters, which are basically the penetration depth and the coherence length. Again, with VSR, we see that we have a square vortex lattice because essentially this most likely field and the minimum field in a triangular lattice are essentially indistinguishable from each other, but in a square lattice, they're physically further apart, and the size of the field is quite different as well. So so that sharp peak here is the sample holder. There's the most likely field, there's the minimum field. And the fact that we can even resolve them tells us right away that we have a square lattice. So we've taken Agterberg's calculation, we've turned that into, and for the microscopic parameters, we turned it around and can now fit the precession data. So here's above TC, and here's below TC with an actual fit. And the microscopic parameters include the coherence length or the Ginzburg-Landau parameter alternatively, and the penetration depth. Having said all that, here's what we get. So the data points here are a fit to an individual spectrum at a particular temperature and a particular field. So we go from 60 Gauss up to 300 Gauss, measuring from about 20 millikelvin up to, in fact, above TC. But of course, we only see broadening below TC, so I'm showing you that data here. And so that we have fits for four different fields. And the fits for all of these, this is a fit to just the weak coupled BCS model. So that temperature dependence is what you expect for a fully gapped Fermi surface, so that there's no nodes in the gap whatsoever. And you see it fits beautifully. So we see no evidence at all for any, at sort of the 10% level, for any effective nodes. So if we had a weakly induced part of the Fermi surface which did have nodes, that those contributions to the superfluid density would add up to each other, and you have to see how much could you add into these curves, temperature dependence in here, to be flat. It's about probably the 10% level. From here we can measure the penetration depth at t equals zero, the extrapolated value, and here we have a plot of that as a function of the magnetic field, and we see if we extrapolate this down to zero temperature, we'd get about this is in nanometers, we get about 100 nanometers. And that is what you'd expect if you calculated from the quantum oscillation measurements and knowing about all the different contributions to the different bands, you'd get that agrees with what you'd get from that point. Okay. We also have data for the c-axis. So if we take the sample, of course, is tetragonal. If we apply the field in the basal plane, then we measure an effective penetration depth in that case, 1 over lambda squared, which is just equal to 1 over lambda c times lambda b. And since we already have measured lambda c for the field along the normal, which is the data I showed you before, we can extract the c component of the penetration depth. And it's much larger. It's instead of being 200 nanometers or so, or 100 nanometers in low field, it's about 4,000 nanometers, so quite long in that direction. And again, it has the same, here I'm plotting it on an expanded scale, different scale. Again, this fits beautifully to an S-wave fully gapped state. So we don't have any evidence for nodes along the other direction of the gap either in this material. So let me conclude now, because I think I'm out of time. We have broken time reversal symmetry in this material. In the Meissner state, this is seen both by ourselves and by Kerr rotation. The penetration depth is, t- tells us that the superconducting state is primarily gapless, or not gapless, sorry, nodeless in the gap. And that, and we do see broken time reversal symmetry in a small, I should say, I haven't showed you all the superconductors where we don't see it, because that's most of them, including the cuprates. But it's a small but increasing number of superconductors. And I think MUSR is obviously a very sensitive probe of doing this. But it's nice to see that there are other probes coming along as well that can add to our understanding and our belief in the results. So thank you very much for your time.
So what are your thoughts on then how to reconcile the ultrasound measurements with what you're seeing here? Or the other evidence for nodes?
Well, it's hard to say. I think one thing that's certainly true is that our measurements, we measure the superfluid part of the conductivity. So we're measuring whereas these other measurements are typically, like the ultrasound, are measuring the effect of the normal state electrons. Now, of course, in a two-fluid model, if you have the superconducting electrons and the normal state electrons, that's kind of all of them. But if the ones that are most promoted first are going to be the ones which have nodes in them, because they'll have excitations at low temperatures, they may give you a strong effect in the normal state transport. But since we won't really, that's where the sort of 10% noise that what you could add in, what could you add? If we have a small normal state, there's an induced sort of gap state as well that would add on to here as well. At the 10% level, we might not be sensitive to it. So that's, I think, that that's a possible explanation, because it's, or at least a route to that. But that's my best guess so far.
I'm just thinking of the difference between UPT3 and strontium ruthenate at zero field. Would you expect if you apply a magnetic field, like if you cool the sample within the magnetic field and then do the measurement, do the zero field measurement with strontium ruthenate, and then
from a practical point of view, you can never do that, and the reason is because these are in order to do the measurement in zero field, you have to have cooled down below TC in zero field, otherwise you'll just trap flux in your sample. And so you can't actually get rid of the field in the sample unless you cool in zero field. So I think it's difficult. That's probably something that's going on with these care rotation measurements a little bit, is to do with, there may be some effect of trapping flux or something like that there. So from a practical point of view in MUSR, we have to actually zero the field extremely precisely. Otherwise, you can fool yourself into making these effects either appear or disappear sort of as you like, if you don't have a really precisely zeroed field. So I don't think we can do the measurements. We can do the precession measurements, obviously, in an applied field. And in the case of uranium platinum 3, what's interesting is that the effect of, the penetration depth in the high temperature phase, the superfluid density is very low, so we essentially do not see any real increase in the broadening to speak of until at the upper transition. We only see it at the lower transition. So there's a much stronger, the low temperature, low field phase has a much larger superfluid density than the other phases. But to do the broken time reversal measurement, you need to have a really zero field.
Can you rule out some kind of ferromagnetic domains or fluctuations by either Kerr effect or MUSR there? Or is it a possibility for time result symmetry breaking?
Well, I guess in some sense, if the system is spontaneously magnet, this in some sense is spontaneously a bit of a ferromagnet.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, but I think.
This can be ruled out with Kerr effect, no? It's like it will have specific response in Kerr effect. If it was a spontaneous ferromagnet domains.
I'm not sure that there's any difference. I think in some sense, what's happening is, I mean, it's ferromagnetism that occurs at TC, and it's the same. There's only one set of electrons in strontium ruthenate, and so they essentially are making a net magnetic moment in the sample. So it's a ferromagnetism, if you like, that's associated with the superconducting state, and I'm not sure that it helps to make too much more of a distinction to me than that.
So this is your view. It's kind of ferromagnetic domains which are responsible for TR breaking.
I think so. That's the most logical. I think that's the simplest explanation. One could imagine there could be some sort of contact interaction, which is also giving a spine a local field at the muon site as a second or origin. But I think that these domain wall currents do have to be there.
Okay. Thanks.
I think Alan had a question. Let's see. I'm trying to remember what was the original motivation for that. In a non-centrist symmetric superconductor, at least the pure identification of an S versus a P and things like that's gone, and so then the question is. I'm trying to remember, but our observation is that at least here you can have either flavor. It doesn't seem to matter. There's at least there's an existence proof for each type of having it or not having it, and so I think that probably that's sort of a different axis. In fact, that doesn't really matter whether it's symmetric, centrosymmetric or not. Whether it'll be something else that determines whether you have broken time reversal symmetry. There's an extra capability, yeah.
Okay, I think we should move on, because we're out of time. So let's thank Graham for his talk again.